The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. From the Harvard Health Letter, trending now, sprouted grains. These grains have more nutrients than regular whole grains, and they may be easier to digest. You know that whole grains are loaded with nutrients and fiber and are an important component of a healthy diet. Now, an early harvesting method for grains, when they're just sprouts, is becoming popular, with sales of sprouted grains predicted to grow eightfold in the United States by 2018. It's one of those trends taking off as people are looking for the next big thing. And in some ways, sprouted grains are a step above regular whole grains, says Christina Cecinaro, a registered dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Benefits of sprouted grains. Sprouted grains are whole grain seeds that have just begun to grow and aren't quite plants yet. Inside the seed's outer shell, the bran, the plant embryo, the germ, relies on the seed's endosperm, the starchy food supply, to fuel its growth. This germinating process breaks down some of the starch, which makes the percentage of nutrients higher. It also breaks down phytate, a form of phytic acid that normally decreases absorption of vitamins and minerals in the body. So sprouted grains have more available nutrients than mature grains. These nutrients include folate, iron, vitamin C, zinc, magnesium, and protein. Another benefit, because the germinating process breaks down some of the starchy endosperm, sprouted grains may have less starch and be easier to digest than regular grains. It may help people who are sensitive to digesting grains. Risks of sprouted grains. In order to catch the sprouts at just the right moment in the growing process, whole grain seeds are typically soaked and then nurtured in environments with controlled amounts of warmth and moisture. This can be done at home in a vented jar or at a food manufacturing plant in special equipment. But in any location, the moist environment can promote bacterial growth. For that reason, it is recommended that you don't eat raw sprouted grains. Instead, mash them into a paste for use in baked goods or cook the raw sprouts before adding them to a meal. Cooking or baking the sprouts should be enough to kill any bacteria. You'll also need to refrigerate cooked sprouts and sprouted grain baked goods. Some food makers also mash the sprouted grains for use in products, or they dry the grains when they sprout and then grind them for use in products. Buying and using sprouted grains. You can find sprouted grains in grocery stores, cook the grains in a little water, and flavor with spices to use as a side dish or add to salads. If you'd like to try products made with sprouted grains, you'll find flours, breads, buns, muffins, tortillas, crackers, and even pizza crust. They should be in a refrigerated or frozen section of the store. If they're not, they probably have preservatives in them, although sprouted quinoa and rice flour is safely kept on the shelf. Whatever you choose, she advises that you read the ingredient list. Sometimes there are just small amounts of sprouted grains in a product, so don't rely on marketing promises on the package. Sprouted grains should be the first ingredient listed. She also points out that sprouted grain products tend to be more expensive than products with regular whole grains. Are they better for health? Sprouted whole grains and regular whole grains contain the same nutrients but in a different quantity. And just because a product contains sprouted whole grains, that doesn't mean it has less or more nutrients than a regular whole grain product. You'll have to read the nutrition facts label to compare nutrition content. Should you make the effort to eat sprouted whole grains? I do think there are benefits to sprouted grains, but they're not a cure-all. I would replace some whole grains with sprouted grains at least once a day, says Secanero. And overall, aim for 3 to 6 servings of whole grains each day. A serving might be a piece of whole grain bread or half a cup of whole grain pasta. And remember that all whole grains are healthier than refined grains, such as the wheat in white bread, which have been milled to remove the bran and germ, the most nutritious part of the whole grain seed. Weighing the risks and benefits of aspirin therapy. It may help prevent a heart attack or stroke, but it comes with the risk of bleeding. Maybe you've heard about people who take a low-dose aspirin each day to ward off heart problems. Since aspirin is a medicine you've probably used now and then without a problem, and since it is available without a prescription, you might consider trying a daily low-dose aspirin yourself. Don't do it. Unlike deciding to take a multivitamin, taking a daily aspirin isn't something you should decide to do on your own. Aspirin therapy is typically prescribed for people who have atherosclerosis of the arteries of the heart or brain or risk factors for the disease. Just who should take a daily aspirin, how much aspirin, and what type of aspirin are hotly debated issues, with clinical trials underway in search of answers. Until those results are in, you should talk to your doctor before starting aspirin, says Dr. Deepak Bhatt, a cardiologist and the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. Why aspirin is prescribed? Everyone's blood has a tendency to form clots. We need clots to stop any bleeding that may start, such as from a cut or stomach ulcer. On the other hand, if clots form too easily, they can plug up an artery, causing a heart attack or the most common kind of stroke. Aspirin works to lower the risk of heart attack and stroke because it reduces the tendency of blood to clot. But that means aspirin also increases the tendency to bleed. Aspirin may be prescribed by itself or in combination with a prescription anti-clotting medication such as Plavix. And it's not just for people who've had a heart attack or stroke or those who have heart disease. Other candidates for anti-clotting therapy include people who've had a coronary artery bypass to reroute blood flow around blockages in the heart, people who've had a stent implanted to keep an artery open, and people with peripheral artery disease, which is significant plaque buildup in the leg arteries. As a preventive therapy, aspirin may be prescribed for people who don't have evidence of cardiovascular disease but do have one or more risk factors such as high cholesterol, a history of high blood pressure, diabetes, a family history of heart disease, cigarette smoking, obesity, physical inactivity. But again, using aspirin therapy if you haven't already had a heart attack or stroke is debated, and some researchers question which risk factors warrant the therapy. How do you determine if aspirin therapy is right for you? Many factors must be considered, such as age, aspirin allergies, severe kidney or liver disease, and use of other medications. A risk calculator from Brigham and Women's Hospital can help guide the discussion between you and your doctor. You can check out the calculator at www.aspiringuide.com. Risks of aspirin. Since aspirin reduces the blood's ability to form clots, it also increases the risk of bleeding. The most common form of serious bleeding is gastrointestinal bleeding. Very rarely, bleeding into the brain can occur, which may result in disability or death. That is why you should discuss whether to be on aspirin therapy with your doctor and not just start taking it, Dr. Bhatt warns. Some conditions, such as uncontrolled high blood pressure or ulcers, can boost the risk of bleeding. When do the benefits outweigh the risks? After a heart attack or certain forms of stroke, the benefits almost always justify aspirin use unless the patient is at a high bleeding risk, Dr. Bhatt explains. Taking aspirin. If your doctor does prescribe aspirin, it may be a low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams, or a regular-size aspirin, 325 milligrams. But even this is debated. A large study is ongoing to see if 81 milligrams or 325 milligrams of aspirin is safer or more effective in reducing the risk for cardiovascular events such as a heart attack, says Dr. Bhatt. Also undetermined is whether it's best to take an aspirin with a safety coating called enteric coating in order to reduce the risk of stomach bleeding. Some data suggest the coating may interfere with the body's ability to absorb the aspirin. When Dr. Bhatt prescribes aspirin therapy, he generally recommends taking 81 milligrams of uncoated aspirin daily. Taking aspirin with food may help avoid stomach upset, he says. And one more point, aspirin therapy doesn't make patients feel better. Are you functionally fit? It's having the strength and motor skills to carry out the activities that get you through each day, and this is from the Harvard Health Letter. You may think of exercise as something you do to keep your heart and lungs healthy or to maintain your weight, and those are great benefits. But exercise is also important to keep you functioning throughout the day, whether you're carrying a laundry basket or playing with your grandkids. The ability to do such ordinary activities is called functional, quote-unquote, fitness. And programs to help people stay functionally fit are a top trend in the exercise world, according to the American College of Sports Medicine. Yet many older adults aren't aware of this type of exercise program. It's not on people's radar, says Clara Saffron Norton, clinical supervisor of rehabilitation services at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Losing function. As we age, we may experience many changes in physical health that affect our daily function. For example, loss of muscle mass and strength, which makes it harder to lift a gallon of water, twist off a jar lid, or open a car door. Stiffer and less flexible muscles, which may lead to difficulty turning your head as you back your car out of a driveway, or trouble reaching up to a cupboard to grab a plate. A weakened sense of balance, which can result in walking problems and an increased risk for falls. Arthritis of the hands, knees, or hips, which can make it hard to dress, bathe, or walk. Boosting functional fitness. Rather than wait for Mother Nature to diminish your ability to get through the day, you can take a preventive approach to increase and protect your functional fitness. A typical functional fitness program will include exercises that mimic daily activities with motions that help your body get better at pushing, pulling, climbing, bending, lifting, reaching, turning, squatting, and rotating your trunk or shoulders. The exercises you do will also train your muscles to work together. The exercise might be mini squats for your leg and hip muscles and planks for better core strength. Those would help you get up from the chair or toilet, go up and down stairs, and get in and out of bed and a car, explains Dr. Saffron Norton. Or if you want to lift grocery bags out of the car, you'll need to bend over, pick them up, lift them, turn to walk away, and then lift items over your head to put them back away. So we might design a rotational trunk exercise. Work on strengthening the triceps, biceps, deltoids, and shoulder blade extensors, and focus on balance. Endurance is also an important part of functional fitness. You can boost it with aerobic exercise, the kind that gets your heart and lungs pumping, such as brisk walking, indoor cycling, or tennis. Where to turn? Consider asking your doctor about going to physical therapy to get a program tailored especially for you. The physical therapist will design a regimen of exercises based on your personal needs. You can expect a comprehensive exam of your flexibility, your range of motion in the arms and legs, and your strength, balance, and coordination. There are specific tests that we do that time how fast you get in and out of a chair and the speed at which you can walk and turn around safely. We can test your balance on one leg versus two legs and your ability to turn and not fall over. These tests translate to everyday function, explains Dr. Saffron Norton. If you feel you're in great shape and would be happier in a class setting, you can find functional fitness classes at local senior centers, YMCAs, and fitness clubs or gyms. Just make sure class is adapted for older adults and that the focus is on activities related to everyday function. If you can't find one of these classes, you could do yoga or modified Pilates. I find those to be geared toward function and balance, Dr. Saffron Norton says. Boosting function at home. You can also do a program of functional fitness exercises at home several days per week. If you go to a gym and use a leg press machine, that's the same activity as standing squats. They both get you stronger, says Dr. Saffron Norton. However, She notes that it's important to get your doctor's okay before starting a program on your own, and that it may be best to do a home program that's designed by physical therapists or a personal trainer rather than finding a program online and trying it on your own. A typical home program should include, number one, flexibility stretches such as reaching your arms overhead or turning your trunk to the right and left or stretching the leg muscles, calves, quadriceps, and hamstrings. Number two, strengthening exercises for your legs and arms that can be done with resistance bands. Three, strengthening exercises for your core abdominal muscles, such as wall push-ups or modified planks. Number four, balance exercises, such as standing on one leg for 30 seconds or longer. Make sure you have something to hold on to in case you feel like you might fall. And finally, exercises that work many muscle groups and simulate daily activities, such as sit to stands. Move of the month, stand up, sit down. Starting position, sit in a chair with your hands crossed on your chest or held out in front of you at chest level. Your feet should be flat on the floor, hip wide apart, and directly beneath your knees. The movement, lean forward slightly and slowly stand up, hold. Slowly sit down with control. Repeat 10 times. Tips and techniques. Press your heels into the floor and tighten your buttocks as you stand up to help you balance. Steady yourself before you sit down and exhale as you stand, inhale as you sit. Make it easier. Place your hands on your thighs or use a chair with armrests to assist you as you stand up and sit down. Do fewer reps. And then make it harder. Modify the exercise by placing your right foot slightly in front of your left one, keeping both feet flat on the floor. Stand up and sit down. Repeat 10 times, and then repeat the exercise with your left leg in front. When your colonoscopy reveals that you have diverticulitis, hemorrhoids, or both, in most cases you won't know they're there, but if things change, home remedies often help. You received good news after your last colonoscopy. No cancer or precancerous polyps, but with the good news came a surprise finding. Though you don't have symptoms, you do have diverticulitis and hemorrhoids. The news may be puzzling, but don't worry. Both conditions are common and usually don't cause any problems, says Dr. Kyle Stoller, a gastroenterologist at Harvard-affiliated Mass General Hospital. Diverticulosis is the term used to describe the presence of diverticula, which are pouch-like structures that sometimes form in the muscular wall of the colon and bulge outward. Between 40 and 60% of people have them, and they get more common as we age. They tend to cluster in the sigmoid colon, just above the rectum. Diverticulosis only causes symptoms if one of the diverticula bleeds or gets infected. When bleeding does occur, it tends to be intense for a short period, but usually stops on its own. We don't know the cause of the diverticular bleeding, only that something injures a blood vessel in the pouch, says Dr. Stoller. Even if bleeding stops on its own, you can still lose a considerable amount of blood, so you should see a doctor. Diverticulitis. In some people, diverticula can get infected. That's called diverticulitis. But it's not as common as having diverticulosis. The lifetime rate of diverticulitis is low, between 4 and 15% of those with diverticulosis, says Dr. Stoller. It's not clear why or how diverticulitis develops. Age, obesity, a lack of exercise, and a low-fiber diet are risk factors for the condition, so is eating red meat. Typical symptoms of diverticulitis include lower abdominal pain, more often on the left side, fever and change in bowel habits, either loose stools or constipation. Most people with diverticulitis will have pain in the left lower part of the abdomen, but no bleeding, says Dr. Stoller. Your doctor will likely order a CT scan to look for active signs of inflammation. Treatment is typically antibiotics for 7 to 10 days. People with more severe disease, such as abscess, which is a pocket of infection, or pus that needs drainage often need hospitalization for intravenous antibiotics. Preventing problems. It's not clear yet if we can prevent diverticulosis or diverticulitis. Exercising, controlling your weight, and eating less red meat and more fiber may help. Some data suggests that more fiber reduces the risk of both developing diverticula and getting symptoms if you already have them, Dr. Steller says. Adults should get 25 to 30 grams of dietary fiber every day from foods such as beans, whole grains, vegetables, and fruits. A fiber supplement may also help, but add fiber to your diet slowly since you can get gas and bloating if you increase your fiber intake too fast. What about the warning that eating foods with small seeds can add to diverticulitis risks? There used to be a theory that seeds, nuts, and popcorn increase the risk of diverticulitis and diverticulitis because they might lodge in the pouches and cause irritation or infection. However, that's never been proved. Seeds and nuts are an important source of fiber, says Dr. Stowler. Hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids have a bad rap, but we all have these pillow-like clusters of veins in the lining of the lower part of the rectum and anus, which help play a role in preventing stool leakage. When they become enlarged, however, they are anything but helpful and can even contribute to some leakage in addition to pain, itching, and bleeding. What causes hemorrhoids to swell? The veins are anchored by connective tissue. If the tissue is weakened, the hemorrhoids bulge out. Dr. Stowler explains, the weakened tissue may be caused by a combination of genetics and pressure from sitting on a toilet too long or straining to have a bowel movement. Pregnancy is also a common trigger. When hemorrhoids in the lower rectum, internal hemorrhoids, swell, they may bleed, and you may see bright red blood in the toilet, but you won't feel the hemorrhoids unless they extend beyond your anus and become itchy. The hemorrhoids most people complain about, which are called external hemorrhoids, are located outside the anus, but if they become swollen, the overlying skin becomes irritated, erodes, and may itch or hurt. A clot can form inside the hemorrhoid, which can be very painful. Treatment and prevention. Hemorrhoids are typically diagnosed from a medical history and physical exam. Home remedies are usually effective to treat external hemorrhoids. Sitting in a warm bath may help soothe an irritated hemorrhoid, and lifestyle changes can also make a difference. Avoid sitting and straining on the toilet for long periods and make sure the stool moves along, says Dr. Stowler. He suggests increasing dietary fiber intake, such as stool softener, such as doxycycline or colase, or using a gentle laxative if you're constipated, such as Miralax. Dr. Stowler does not recommend using over-the-counter creams, which are steroids thought to help shrink inflammation. There's no evidence they work. Internal hemorrhoids that are both bothersome are usually resolved with minimally invasive procedures performed in a doctor's office. New motivation to move on. We know sedentary time is bad for us. Previous research has suggested a link between the total amount of time spent sitting each day and health problems or even early death. Now, an observational study published online September 12, 2017 by Annals of Internal Medicine suggests that it also matters how many minutes at a time you spend sitting in an office chair or lounging on a couch. Researchers looked at the health and activity of about 8,000 men and women ages 45 or older who wore activity trackers for a week, and then they followed the participants for 4 years. Sitting for 30, 60, or 90 minutes at a time was associated with the greatest risk for deaths if sedentary time was more than 12 or 13 hours per day. Sitting less than 30 minutes at a time was associated with a lower risk of death during the follow-up period, regardless of the total amount of inactivity for the day. But study authors point out that an inactive lifestyle is hazardous no matter how you rack up sedentary time. The takeaways: study authors say their findings support guidelines that recommend we all get up and move every 30 minutes. Watch out for two different nutrition facts labels. Bracing yourself for confusion when looking at food labels. The FDA is delaying the launch of its new nutrition facts label, which features clearer serving sizes, a new line for added sugars, and the actual amounts of vitamins and minerals, not just percentages of daily values. Large food makers were supposed to start using the updated design by July 2018, and smaller companies had until July 2019. Now the FDA is extending the deadlines to January 2020 and January 2021, respectively. The FDA says the extra time will give the agency a chance to lend guidance to manufacturers, but some food makers have already rolled out the new labels on their products. This means consumers will see two different types of nutrition labels for years to come, which could be confusing. Ironically, however, remember that fresh whole foods that don't have a label, especially fruits and vegetables, may be your wisest choice, says registered dietitian Kelly McManus. Treating inflammation protects the heart. People with coronary artery disease or strong risk factors for developing it are often treated with statin drugs. Statins were developed to treat high levels of LDL or bad cholesterol because such high levels increase the risk of coronary artery disease. Studies convincingly showed that statins do indeed reduce both cholesterol and the risk of coronary artery disease, as expected. However, a large Harvard study published in 2008 found that statins also lower the risk even in people with normal LDL levels. Why? Many doctors speculated that the reason might be that statins also reduce inflammation, another contributor to heart attacks and stroke. A new Harvard study published online August 27, 2017 by the New England Journal of Medicine used a novel medication called canakinumab, which attacks inflammation but does not lower LDL cholesterol. The study involved over 10,000 people who had suffered a heart attack and whose blood showed a modest level of inflammation. Inflammation-fighting medicine lowered the rates of heart attacks, strokes, and death from heart disease. This study supports the theory that the beneficial effects of statins may result from their ability to both lower cholesterol and tamp down inflammation. It also will lead to further study of this new drug as well as other treatments for inflammation. So coming up in the medical letter, are you prepared for a medical emergency? The five mistakes that will trip up any diet. What to look for in a home treadmill, and why sinusitis is common in our older years. We'll also discuss Ask the Doctor, does bariatric surgery have lasting benefits, and how to cope with motion sickness. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. And if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Stay healthy.